Good morning. First case of the morning be Hoskins versus Sheehan. Who's up first? Ms. Anderson?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Arlene Anderson on behalf of the sheriff and the county this morning. This case stems from an incident that occurred in the parking lot of Cook County Jail in 2001. Ms. Hoskins alleged that another correctional officer, defendant Keith, struck her during a dispute over a parking space. Although the facts of that particular incident are disputed,
it's kind of road rage, only it was not. It was after the road.
Yes, that's correct, Judge.
Post-road rage, perhaps.
Post-road rage, exactly.
Good. You know how to characterize it anyway.
The facts that are not in dispute here are that Ms. Hoskins immediately reported the incident to two lieutenants who supervised Correctional Officer Keith. Those two lieutenants told her to report it to Internal Affairs and also to her own supervisor, which she did. Ms. Hoskins then went to Internal Affairs with her supervisor, made the report, and then went to the Chicago Police Department at one point and made a police report. She also testified that she left a message on an anonymous person's voicemail at the state's attorney's office, and she alleges that that was part of her reporting, part of her speech in this case. After the investigation by Internal Affairs, that investigator found that the evidence against Correctional Officer Keith was inconclusive. However, he did make a finding that Ms. Hoskins used profanity during the incident, and as a result, he recommended that she be disciplined. That was sent to her supervisor, Patricia Tolbert, who then decided that the appropriate discipline in that case was a 3-day suspension. Now, that occurred in July of 2002, and sometime during the year of 2002, Ms. Hoskins found out that she was the one that was going to be disciplined, and she took that through a grievance proceeding, grievance procedures through the union collective bargaining agreement, and eventually agreed at one of the stages of the grievance procedure to have that reduced to a written reprimand. So even though she had served her 3-day suspension, she was reimbursed for that the days that she was off. Ms. Hoskins also alleges, and the testimony at trial indicated that she had conversations with several coworkers about the incident, and it's those discussions as well as the reporting of the incident that she claims were protected under the First Amendment, and we would like to discuss the speech in detail this morning.
Yeah, I think, I was going to say, I think that's what you should get to, because your argument is that under Garcetti, she wasn't speaking as a citizen, but only acting pursuant to her job duties. And there's a, so I think you really need to deal with that.
And I think the first thing you need to deal with is the pretrial order, because that's where this issue wasn't raised, and that's where Judge Shader said, whatever you want to call it, waived, forfeited, and all that sort of thing. And that seems to be the first hurdle.
Yes. There were a rather unusual set of circumstances that resulted in Judge Shader just brushing aside the issue of whether this was protected under the First Amendment.
But the bottom line is you never put the Garcetti issues in play before the trial. They were not raised in any Rule 50 or post-trial motion either.
They were raised in a motion for summary judgment.
But they were not preserved in the pretrial order, were they?
They were not, Your Honor, but that was because that particular question is a legal question. It's not a question for the jury. So there was some confusion as to why Judge Shader was making making us put it into a pretrial order.
Well, but let's get back to you. Said you put the Garcetti argument in your summary judgment motion. I thought your summary judgment motion only argued that the statements didn't involve matters of public concern, not the Garcetti line.
Well, Garcetti had not come down yet, so we didn't specifically argue the case of Garcetti, but we argued that the that her speech, none of her speech, was protected under the First Amendment. And under the court's case law, that's sufficient to raise a Garcetti-type question.
Well, the point is, in your summary judgment, you did raise matters of public concern.
Correct.
It was not in the pretrial order.
It was not in the pretrial order, but...
And that, and both of these judges have tried a lot of cases. I have not. I was never a trial judge, but it is my understanding that in cases that I had to work with in the pretrial order, if the court wants the pretrial order to consolidate the case, that has to be a part of it. And I look at this case, it's a major part of it. It's pivotal. This whole issue is a question of whether or not what she expressed and how she expressed it was protected by the First Amendment as matters of public concern, or whether it's just inner office banter and personal griping. We don't seem to have that issue preserved, and that seems to be a problem.
Well, the question of whether or not speech is protected under the First Amendment is not a jury issue. It's a question of law for the district court or the trial judge to determine prior to a case going to the jury. And the motion for summary judgment was denied on the same date that the pretrial order was entered. And it, we can't...
So the summary judgment motion was under was taken under before we got around to the discussion of the pretrial order.
That's correct.
In timing.
That's correct.
The judge has before him the motion for summary judgment what raises the issue of non-constitutional
yes.
speech,
yes.
constitutionally protected speech. Then he denies that.
He denies it on the same day that the pretrial order is entered.
And then the pretrial order is entered.
On the same date.
I'm getting the timing.
Yes.
It goes summary judgment, pretrial order.
Yes. And it's... I think after that, counsel for the sheriff was confused as to whether the judge actually thought that was a jury issue, knowing that it was not. So that's when she went back to him and said, listen, are you planning on making a determination as to whether or not this is protected speech? And that's when Judge Shader came back to her and said, well, this is being raised for the first time. I think if you look at the record closely, you'll see that Judge Shader at various points made statements as to the fact that this was being raised for the very first time, that this was not even raised in a motion for summary judgment. And he then kind of came back and we submit hung his hat on the fact that he didn't see it specifically expressly raised in the pretrial order. But at various times, he indicated to counsel that he didn't think that the claim had been raised whatsoever at any time at all. And that's why he was finding it forfeited.
But the record clearly shows it was raised in the summary judgment motion.
It clearly shows that, Your
Honor. Okay.
Clearly.
Let me ask you a different question. She was a social worker, Ms. Hoskins, and so she wasn't employed to report incidents of off-duty misconduct, was she? In other words, her job didn't require her to report this incident to the state's attorney or the police department or anything, did it?
It required her to, and she in fact admitted at trial that the general orders of the sheriff's office apply to employee or to citizen employees. And she was under a duty to report that incident to her immediate supervisor or up through the chain of command, which
even
is
though it was
did.
An off-duty incident.
Yes. Yes. And she admitted at trial that she was under a duty to report that. And so that's what she did. Was she under a duty with respect to her employment to report it to the police department? No, and we don't submit that she was under a duty to do that.
Or the state's attorney.
But, I mean, with respect to the state's attorney, all she did was leave a message on voicemail. She never followed up on that. With respect to the Chicago Police Department, we submit that all she was doing is furthering her own private interest. She was trying to get Officer Keith arrested. That was her own private concern. Of course, the public has an interest in public safety and things like that, but that was not her purpose. Her purpose in reporting that incident to the police department was to get Officer Keith arrested. It was not to address any kind of a matter of public interest. And with respect to the comments and the discussions that she had with her coworkers about how she didn't think that it was fair that Officer Keith eventually was disciplined after this went through the command channel review at the sheriff's office. But initially, she thought that she was the only one being disciplined in the incident and that Officer Keith wasn't. Well, all of her comments and her discussions with coworkers involved how she thought that she was essentially getting screwed here. And again, it was these were all matters concerning her own private interest. They did not involve any kind of public discourse as to what was going on at the sheriff's office and how they handle their disciplinary procedures there.
Now, that would be a matter of public concern, would it not? If this is a pervasive situation or where there's special treatment for people of different influence and goes on as a regular going on in the department, that would be a matter of public concern, wouldn't it?
If that had been the context, Your Honor, yes.
Yeah, that's why I'll call it a hypothetical.
Yes.
That would be a problem. Then
that would be if that had been the context.
And then the next question would be, how does one express that as a matter of public concern as opposed to an internal gripe?
Well, first of all, she would have to have had those discussions with supervisors, at least supervisors inside the office. But she was talking to her coworkers, and there was no evidence that this information that she was discussing with coworkers ever even got back to supervisors. And most of the evidence at trial indicated that these statements or these conversations she had with coworkers were made after she was disciplined. So how can we relate that back to cause for her discipline when these statements were made after she was disciplined?
We're into your rebuttal time. I just want
Your Honors, we would ask, if my time runs out, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be vacated and be sent back and with instructions to enter judgment in favor of the defendants in this case.
Mr. Floretti.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bob Fioretti, and I represent Donald Keith here in this action, along with Paul Peldiak. May it please the court, counsels. I believe the briefs have extensively dealt with the issues that are at hand. However, there are four issues, two of which I think I'll only have time for. We have 8 minutes here. And the first issue is whether the trial court erred by allowing the state court claim of assault and battery against Donald Keith to proceed in a federal court by erroneously interpreting Section 1367 and applying supplemental jurisdiction over that claim.
You know, the problem I have with that argument is didn't the jury need to hear about the parking lot incident in order to understand the First Amendment claim? And aren't the federal and state claims part of the same operative facts? I mean, there's a common nucleus that binds them together because of the parking lot and the action.
There would be, but not in this case. I'm trying to discern what, how was Donald Keith acting under color of law, first of all? How was Donald Keith doing, what were the facts here in this case that created the common nucleus of operative facts? The only thing that we have is the parking lot dispute, the road rage, as it was referred to. And if we look at those set of questions, and all we have is something happening between a Cook County Sheriff's deputy who's 61 years old, who mans some jail cell at that point, and a Department of Correction employee out there, also a social worker, who's out there. They have a dispute over a space. Granted, whether or not, and the facts were somewhat in dispute, even though the jury believed that he did strike her the one time, that whether or not he hit her. Now, from that point on, where the whether he hit her or not, we were going to assume for, because the jury found he hit her. From that point, everything rolls differently. The genesis of this case starts from there. That's the only tie between the cases. We have a separate sheriff's policy. The sheriff's policy did not cause Donald Keith to act here. The sheriff's policy did not cause, it preceded the federal claim for all intents and purposes. And, you know, when we look at the three of you know better than all of us in this court that, you know, these are courts of limited jurisdiction. And to assume that 1367 all of a sudden takes this case in and says, yes, it's the after the fact. It's all after the fact here. And you know, if we're going to look at what the intent was of what Congress had intended to limit where we go with this type of case, to limit the supplemental jurisdiction, it is clear that this happens before. And it's really an afterthought because the plaintiff's own complaint that was drafted cites the alleged discriminatory policy of the sheriff's office as count one, count two, against Donald Keith, and count three against Donald Keith against for the assault and for the battery claims. There is no actual use of Section 1983 bringing Donald Keith into this action. I mean, this is an afterthought. I mean, could Donald Keith have come to the case to testify again, for the first claim? The answer is probably yes. Was Donald Keith necessary in this whole case? The answer is no. He was not a necessary party. This was clearly and only a state court case here.
Is the comparative punishment relevant in the case, or you say that should just be a state court case? Comparative punishment. She was complaining because she was treated.
Oh, no. Because the punishment issues were ill-defined in the course of the proceedings, but the punishment issue was, if at all, a 1983 action, which didn't involve Keith as a participant. He didn't exercise the policy.
She's beefing about what happened after the incident, the way she was treated, which has nothing to do with the fight itself.
Right.
Except for the jury to consider whether the internal investigation was legitimate, didn't they need to hear the facts about the parking lot incident?
You see, but that all wraps up into the type of jury instructions.
You don't much care whether they heard it as long as your client wasn't a party to it as of 1983 Act.
That's correct.
They could hear anything they wanted to as long as he doesn't get tapped for a violation of her constitutional rights because she got disciplined.
Right.
Because he had nothing to do with the discipline.
Right. And then when you tie it in, you know, I, as we go through this, it really then becomes an issue of how the cumulative set of errors that were, you know, I walked into the case.
Well, there wouldn't be error to let, as Judge Williams pointed out, it wouldn't be error for the jury to hear the facts of the fight, but not with your client as a defendant, is what your position is.
Right.
That after they done that, the question of whether or not they acted properly, the sheriff's office and his disciplinary group acted properly, is totally apart, and that is a 1983 action.
Right.
All right. At least they know where we are.
We've heard that saying over and over. Let's not make a federal case out of it. But this is a type
Listen,
of...
Listen, I'm all in favor of making federal cases out of it. That's what
right, I know. So there it is. There we go. And that was the problem here. And because of all that, because of the evidence that came in against the sheriff on the database, this could have been avoided in several ways. The exercise of supplemental jurisdiction here in this case was inappropriate. It should never have occurred.
That's the beginning and the end of your argument, isn't it?
Well, I would hope so. But even then, you can see how the cumulative effects that occurred in this case, that, and including to the end, the jury instructions on what were the combined damages that there was in the jury instructions.
You didn't object to that.
At the time, I believe we did not object to that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So,
but you know, if we look at it, you see, it goes to the cumulative errors that occur.
No, if you weren't supposed to be in the case in the first place, it wouldn't make any difference to you what the hell the jury instructions are. When you get to the jury instruction part, if you're right, you could stand there quietly looking out the window because you wouldn't be nailed anyway. But if the instructions compel them to bring a verdict against your client based on the action of somebody else, then you've got a beef coming. That's what you're talking about.
That's correct.
At least I understand the problem.
That's right. And all of those cumulative effects, including the weighing of the punitive damages here in this case, the errors throughout the case, the disparaging of all of the counsels, whether they were in front of the jury or outside of the jury, all added to a cumulative effect of a verdict that was excessive here, that was wrong. But I think the main part of the argument, though, goes again to the exercise of supplemental jurisdiction. And for those reasons, I believe that this decision should be reversed and remanded, or in the alternative, the case should be dismissed. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Langone?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'd like to touch first quickly on the jurisdictional
issue. Let me back up.
Sure.
Is it your position that Keith was acting under color of state law when the altercation occurred?
It is not.
So he's nothing to do with the 1983 action at all?
Correct. We only brought common law, state court, tort claims against him for battery and assault. And in terms of the supplemental jurisdiction issue, while obviously I am aware that this court has repeatedly held you can challenge jurisdiction at any time in any
Amen.
Court. This court also held in Velker versus Porsche Cars, and we quoted this in our brief on page 55, that in the context of supplemental jurisdiction, and I'm quoting from the court now, given that neither party objected to the district court's de facto exercise of its supplemental jurisdiction and no exceptional circumstances exist, any possible issue of whether the district court abused its discretion by exercising supplemental jurisdiction over the Magnuson-Moss claims is waived. So in Velker versus Porsche Cars, the court held that if you're looking simply at exercising supplemental jurisdiction over additional claims, that is an abuse of discretion standard, and it is waivable. And these arguments were not made below, and they're trying to cast
supplemental jurisdiction would be important if Keith were a party to the 1983 action portion of it.
I'm sorry, if...
I say the supplemental jurisdiction would be important as a problem if Keith were a part of the 1983 action itself.
Well, he was part of the overall factual context because...
Was he charged as part of the 1983 violation?
No.
So the jury was instructed that he was only to be considered in terms of the altercation in the parking lot
Correct.
As a state supplemental thing.
Yes.
That whatever they did with the sheriff and his group had nothing to do with Keith.
Correct.
That's what they were told.
That's what they were told. And I think that was made very clear to the jury, which I think also refutes Keith's argument that somehow he was prejudiced by not getting his own trial. All below, he was saying, I want to sever the trial. I want to sever the trial. He wasn't bringing up jurisdiction. He was just saying, I don't want to be lumped in with the county. And I think that the court made it very clear that there was two jobs the jury had to do, and they were independent, although they involved the same nucleus of operative fact.
They really didn't. They involved two separate groups of facts. One was the altercation. The real principal beef that got you into the federal court was what happened after that.
Right, but the jury can't consider the First Amendment claims without understanding the nature, the full extent of the altercation, mm-hmm. and how comparable discipline is administered, which is why the discipline database was entered into evidence and important.
Well, there's no question they could hear it, but we've already worked that out. I mean, they have to find out what the underlying thing, but that doesn't get that portion of it into the other.
I know, and there used to be, right, all this pendant party claims ancillary, and I think all that was collapsed into this general doctrine of supplemental jurisdiction. So I think your Honor's questions are almost like, well, Keith would, I guess, in the, you know, way back 50 years ago or whenever it was they had that pendant party jurisdiction, there would be that whole body of law that deals with pendant party jurisdiction. But that
I'm very, very old man, and I remember.
Right, exactly. I was going to say, watch yourself 50 years ago.
I remember being part of law school, but not much more about it, other than told it was basically abolished under the supplemental jurisdiction.
Supplemental jurisdiction is an add-on for judicial economy, so we don't have to try everything three or four times.
Right, which is why I think it's an abuse of discretion standard and waivable, as this court held in Velker versus Porsche Carson.
So your bottom line is he should have raised that objection to the supplemental jurisdiction from the get-go.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that's on the claims.
Now, but he chose to just move for severance.
Correct. And repeatedly he did argue that, but that's not his argument here now on appeal. And that's also with the county's arguments. We're seeing arguments that were not made, and that they're trying to.
But didn't the summary judgment raise the issue?
The summary judgment did not raise the issue of Garcetti specifically.
Garcetti hadn't come down, as was pointed out.
Well, but Garcetti issues were being raised in Spiegelio.
If I understand correctly, their position is they did raise that issue.
They made a generic assertion that the speech was not of public concern, which is, I think, very different than was made pursuant to her official job duties. I mean, there was a whole body of law before, right? That's what Connick and all those cases are about, is the speech of public concern. And they were arguing that it was a purely personal, you know, gripe, personal employment gripe, not a matter of public concern.
Doesn't that raise the issue pretty clearly?
No, I don't think it does, because the Garcetti issue was it made pursuant to official job duties, and the Supreme Court held that if it's a job requirement, then it can't be a matter of public concern. But that's different. They didn't raise that issue about it being a specific job duty and required by the general orders, and even social workers off duty have to abide by it as part of their official job duties. Those arguments were never made on summary judgment. And I think another important factor about summary judgment is we were never asked by the district court to respond to summary judgment. So there's no summary judgment record for this court to review, right?
There is the motion itself and the denial of the motion. It's
correct.
And if it was appropriately raised in the motion, and we look at the denial, whether you filed an answer or not.
Well, first of all, I believe that there's no substantive right to move for summary judgment, right? A district court has.
You don't have to. You're not required to move for it. But once it's raised, His Honor has a duty to rule on the motion for summary
judgment. Or say, take it under advisement pursuant to the trial. I think the court has the discretion to say, as Judge Shader did in this case, he denied it without prejudice to raising it in a Rule 50 motion, which they never did. So he didn't rule against any party on the issue. It's not like in Chemtal, where they raised an affirmative defense and the district court ruled on it after briefing on the merits. And then this court said, well, it was a discreetly severable defense that had been briefed.
Well, you don't deny that he denied the motion for summary judgment. However,
he denied it without prejudice. He struck it. I mean,
you don't know where you're going at that stage of the game.
Well, because he told them to re-raise it as a Rule 50 motion, which they never did. And they're trying to dodge this by saying that they don't have to raise it in a Rule 50 motion because it's an issue of law. But issues of law are not just, like, measured in the abstract. They still have to be evaluated against a factual record that's adduced. And there was no opportunity to adduce a factual record on Garcetti issues because it was never raised in the pretrial order. And that's why we have a pretrial order, to frame the issues. It wouldn't be fair to me now on appeal to look back at this trial record that never put me on notice that I should be putting in evidence of Garcetti issues because it wasn't in the pretrial order, and then say, well, there's no evidence in the record on Garcetti issues. Even though there is, as it came in collaterally on other issues, I could have put forth a much stronger case on Garcetti if I had to, pointed out that she was complaining to the state's attorney. You know, as the Ninth Circuit held In Freitag versus Ayers, which we cite on page 53 of our brief, the plaintiff's, quote, right to complain both to an elected public official and to an independent state agency is guaranteed to any citizen in a democratic society, regardless of his status as a public employee. So her speech to the state's attorney, that trying to get him prosecuted, as they acknowledged in oral argument, any citizen has a right to try to get somebody prosecuted for punching them in the face. Except Ms. Hauskins, because she was a public employee in this context. She made union complaints and followed through with a grievance, which was also acknowledged in oral argument. So this argument that she didn't complain to her supervisors, well, there's a procedure for filing those complaints to your supervisors. It's a union grievance procedure, and she enacted her rights under that and was retaliated against. And she was not allowed to press charges, as any citizen would do, and she did complain to her coworkers, and she did complain to her supervisors, and as a result, she was disciplined. She was punished for using profanity. And as the discipline database showed, she's virtually the only person in the entire jail that was punished for using profanity.
That's the first time I had ever heard of police officers being against profanity, but they go ahead.
Well, that was the evidence at trial, quite frankly, Your Honor, was that profanity is profusively used in the jail. And
well, not just
used
in the jail anymore. I mean, it's used every place except church, I think. But
That's true. But
let me have you turn to something else. The requirement that the speech involve a matter of public concern, what's your best evidence that the statements involve a matter of public concern instead of involving matters of just personal interest to her?
Because the statements are of the nature that Keith won't get any discipline, nothing will happen to him, his son was in a highly elite sort unit, and so there's this concern about clout, selective discipline, and the code of silence, that officers don't testify against other officers. Sure enough, in this case, Lieutenant Calderon did not testify against Keith, said she never punched her. So it's these concerns that are of public concern, the code of silence, the police code of silence, which, you know, you hear about and see in Chuck Norris movies, right, but everybody always denies exists, is a matter of public concern. And as social workers in the jail, seeing day to day when they see prisoner complaints, because prisoners make the complaints to them, and then they go and they try to follow up, and so that these officers were talking about their personal experience, and this broader issue of the code of silence permeated the trial.
But see, the thing is, the matters of public concern, sure, those could be. They're also matters of personal concern. Internally, and that's where they discuss it. It would seem to me if a matter is a matter of public concern, usually those cases come up when someone expresses themselves publicly. And then it's a question of whether that is their personal gripe or whether the matter that they expressed in public. And I don't see where she has gone beyond the internal contacts.
Well, like to the state's attorney.
Well, that's
Friday.
Now, of course, in that question, whether it's confined to whether she wants him prosecuted because of injury to herself or whether she's talking about something more global. This is going on everywhere.
Right. I believe that the statement to the state's attorney is part of public concern.
Didn't she just recount to him in the message her own personal grievance? There was no reference to any of this code of silence or anything, was there? I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. Same thing with the police department. Does it indicate she expressed any concern to these agencies beyond the effect on persons other than herself?
She wanted to get them criminally prosecuted. I mean, there was no evidence specifically, did she say to Dick Devine, there's a code of silence going on? No. But, of course, why would we put that evidence in when they waived it in the pretrial order? I don't want to get into the trap here of trying to argue the Garcetti issue on the merits, because I argue it solely in the context of harmless error, right? If this court finds that Judge Shader somehow abused his discretion by enforcing the clear rules about the pretrial order, and then if this court finds that somehow it's going to overlook the fact that they never moved for a new trial, which you think would be the remedy, right, for that kind of district court error, because they don't move for a new trial, the remedy's not smash the plaintiff with judgment notwithstanding the verdict. They could have moved, then, had they moved for a new trial, this court could have said, well, you know, we think Judge Shader was a little harsh and did abuse his discretion. I suppose I don't think that's what the law says, but the remedy would be a new trial. Not Judge Shader didn't let them raise this issue. Mr. Langone therefore never put any evidence in of that. Therefore, we're going to enter judgment against him. That's not fair to me because they waived an issue. They never moved for a new trial. They asked for a new trial in the conclusion of their reply brief. In the wherefore clause, they throw in for the very first time, for all foregoing reasons, this court should either vacate the judgment and, two, remand for a new trial. Well, you can't stick in a request for a new trial in a reply brief on appeal. They never moved, you know, at the beginning they called the verdict a windfall verdict. Well, they never moved for remitter. They never moved for a new trial. The quantum of the verdict is not at issue on this appeal, and they're just, you know, to even view it that way is improper. They didn't make the appropriate motions that they needed to be made, repeatedly. Not only did they not adequately preserve things in the pretrial order, but they didn't do their job post-trial. And Judge Shader gave them an opportunity. They made an oral motion for a Rule 50 motion, and he said that's taken under advisement and gave them time to supplement it with any other post-trial motions. And the Supreme Court in Unitherm held unequivocally that this court lacks the authority to enter a judgment against a prevailing party if that issue was not raised in a Rule 50 motion. So if there's a jurisdictional issue in this appeal, it's that this court lacks the authority, which I guess when the Supreme Court says a court lacks the authority, they didn't frame it as jurisdiction, they said the court lacks the authority, which I interpret as jurisdictional, that this court cannot do a judgment as a matter of law on any big ground not specifically raised in a Rule 50 motion. And the only argument that they specifically raised in the Rule 50 motion was one of the three ways under Monell. They argued we didn't prove custom. They didn't argue their Pembauer arguments. They didn't argue that Ernesto Velasco, as the executive director of the jail, is not a sufficiently high policymaking authority. They didn't argue the Garcetti issues in a Rule 50 motion. They didn't argue any of that until now. And these are not, as they characterize it in their reply brief, a morass of procedural dodges.
Let me just go back for a minute. In terms of the jury instruction, the custom jury instruction, they didn't object to that either, did they?
No, they didn't object to the custom. They didn't. They waived a lot of their arguments. And so they can't just have new counsel step in on appeal or, you know, as part of new state's attorneys step in on appeal and come up with all kinds of arguments that should have been made below. And I don't think that this court should view that as procedural dodges or try to say that somehow I'm trying to avoid inquiry on the merits by raising these issues. I am disadvantaged in trying to meet a Garcetti standard on a record that wouldn't have as much evidence as possible had that issue been adequately preserved in the pretrial order and put me on notice, hey, make sure you get your Garcetti evidence in. You know, we would have gone the extra mile in that regard, right? Not that we didn't go the extra mile in every way we could, but we did it under the issues that the pretrial order said were going to be the issues in the case and the issue in the trial. And yes, in the course of proving my Monell arguments, we were able to adduce some evidence that I can now argue to you even meets the Garcetti standard. So, but, you know, again, in the context of harmless error, because the real issues in this appeal are the Supreme Court's opinion in Unitherm, and what does Rule 50 mean? And you know, that they even try to argue, well, the rule was changed effective December 1st, 2006, right? Which, you know, in footnote 1, they argue that. But that's almost a frivolous argument because, obviously, this case went to trial before December 2006, went to trial in May of 2006.
But Unitherm, didn't that just address sufficiency of the evidence challenges?
That's what they're trying to frame it as, yes. They're trying to say, well, Unitherm only dealt with sufficiency of the evidence challenges, and this wasn't a jury question.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, that just because it's not a jury question doesn't mean that you don't view it in the context of an evidentiary record. And the evidentiary record is what is adduced at trial. The pretrial order deals with a lot of things other than jury instructions. There's agreed statements of contested issues of fact and law. There's agreed statements of fact. There's discussions of how many settlement discussions have there been so far. The pretrial order is the overarching document that defines the entire trial, not just what questions get submitted to a jury. Courts hear claims all the time where there's equitable claims joined with legal claims, and they submit some claims to the jury and then decide the legal claims on their own. But they decide those legal claims in the connection with a factual record adduced at a trial. And that factual record adduced at the trial is defined by the pretrial order. And they did not raise it as an issue in the pretrial order. And they could have raised it as an issue. Yeah, Garcetti hadn't come out yet, but this issue was percolating in the circuits. The circuit split was emerging. The state's attorneys were raising these very same issues in Spiglia. The first time around, this court said no, and then after Garcetti, this court said yes. But those issues were being raised in those other cases from the get-go, from the very beginning. State's attorneys are public officials. They know what these are. There's not that much development in this area of the law. Garcetti, you know, wasn't like, oh, surprise, look at this. People that know about public employment law knew that that issue was evolving. in the circuits, and they should you have to preserve it. You can't just start brand new after the Supreme Court and say, well, we're in the appellate pipeline, so you know they should have been raising this issue at the motion to dismiss stage and at the summary judgment stage. They didn't even specifically say on summary judgment that they were going to try to say this was part of her official job duties. So I really, you know, I don't want to get into like the Garcetti trap in the sense of trying to like argue that we meet Garcetti as if that was my only argument. Because even if we don't meet Garcetti, we still should win this appeal because they never preserved those issues adequately. And this court can't, under Unitherm, take that verdict away because of their waiver. But, you know, I'm also cognizant of doctrines like harmless error, and I do believe that speaking out to a state's attorney and demanding that criminal charges be brought is protected speech. It's not just speech of public concern. It can, I think, also be private speech. You don't check your rights as a citizen at the, you know, public employer's door. She has rights as a citizen, and those rights, even one of them obviously is to speak out of public concern, but another is to try to get somebody arrested and prosecuted for a crime. And another is to be able to speak to your coworkers and say, you know, I think that it's unfair because of all the clout that Keith has that he's never going to get punished. These rights to speak, you don't check them at the door. And this is not a situation where, for instance, if she had said, I interviewed a prisoner and I filled out a report and the prisoner complained of abuse and I turned that in, and that's my job as a social worker, and they turned around and fired me for doing my job and turning in and taking down a prisoner's report, classic Garcetti issue, right? That would be a classic Garcetti issue because her job as a social worker would be to do things like that. But that's not what happened here. This was an off-duty altercation involving two people that happened to work at the same place, one in a kind of higher level, and she exercised her rights as a citizen. If you look and read the closing argument that the county gave and the state's attorney gave, it was they said she didn't act like a normal complainant. They actually tried to make that a theme at the end, that a normal battery victim would have acted differently and that she didn't act like a normal battery victim. Well, that's because a normal battery victim doesn't work for the county and doesn't have to worry about losing their job if they complain against a county sheriff.
Well, battery victim is a battery victim. It doesn't matter how they act, whether they fall down or yell and scream or cry or something. I'm talking about, though, what she does is a matter of public concern and how she expresses it. And you may be correct that just simply contacting the prosecutor and saying, I want him prosecuted, you know, I'm injured and that sort of thing, that certainly self-serving, but if that also serves as expressing to outside whatever confines she has in her own edification, if that works, okay. But that seems to be all she did externally.
Well, that's one. And she contacted the Chicago police, and she made union complaints. And
the union complaint, is that a way of raising matters of public concern when the union is representing her as a worker and all that?
Well, that's speaking out. That's exercising her rights as a citizen.
Okay,
it's not just speaking out on public concern. And again, we have a much fuller factual palette to work with here if they had done what the rules required.
I understand that. But I'm just trying to look at what actually happened. Obviously, she could have called the newspaper. She could have done other things, gotten out on the steps and raised Cain, get all kinds of attention. Then, of course, that's easy.
Right. Although technically she couldn't because the general orders actually prohibit you from contacting the newspaper. So
whatever they say, that's a lot of times people do what they're told not to do, and that's how it becomes a matter of public concern. Anyhow, I'm just trying to explore a little bit here.
So, yeah, I think that it would be an interesting issue that I think would be much easier to explore had, again, all these issues not been waived. The Monell issues, I think, are all adequately addressed in the brief. You know, I do want to comment that, you know, Director Velasco, she was fired on the directive of the executive director of the jail. And they never raised that issue in a Rule 50 motion either. And then we had all of those custom pieces of evidence about the discipline database and the code of silence and examples of selective discipline. So there was an extensive factual record that was built. They didn't address it in oral argument today because I think that they realize that they don't have the best of some of those arguments. They're really trying to shoehorn this kind of retroactively into Garcia. And there's a whole retroactivity issue as well, of course. And we argue in the brief that in the context of this case that Garcetti should not be applied retroactively, again, because it was never raised. We weren't given a heads up on this issue at any level of this proceeding.
Getting back to the Monell issue, even though the sheriff was the final policymaker for Monell purposes, he wasn't personally involved in the discipline in this case, was he? Is there any evidence he knew about it?
No. Well, to be personally involved in the sense that he was personally involved in the decision to make Ernesto Velasco the director of the jail and to delegate to him. In the office of the sheriff, he has the authority to do that. The statute makes him responsible. It's actually Ernesto Velasco who signs the general orders. So the policymaker is in the jail is Ernesto Velasco, because the jail is a discrete part of the overall, right? The sheriff does a lot of things other than run the jail. But in terms of running the jail, the policymaker is Ernesto Velasco. He's the one that signs the very general orders that they're saying bound her to make this report, which are included in their appendix, are signed by Ernesto Velasco. So if he's signing the general orders, he's clearly the policymaker.
And then in terms of your best, what's your strongest evidence that this, because you alluded to some of the evidence you had on Monell and you've covered it in your brief, but what's your strongest evidence that there was permanent or well-settled custom in the department?
I think the discipline database really is the best evidence, because there you get to look at all discipline across a wide variety, and you were able to specifically see that she was the only person that was singled out as a social worker. And then, of course, you have all of the discussions about the social worker evidence talking about how the police do not testify against each other. Even in this case, the two officers, Sergeant Calderon and the other lieutenant, did not testify against Keith. So, I mean, that custom is obviously, to say my strongest, I don't want to point to one piece, right, because it needs to be a pattern and much broader. So, but I think the discipline database covers that in the best way possible. So I see my time is up, and I would urge that the court affirm the verdict and apply these waiver rules strictly as intended. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Anderson, you've got about a minute.
In my time, I just would like to address counsel's arguments taking us to task for not raising the First Amendment issue in a Rule 50 motion. That was not a jury issue. And actually, when counsel for the sheriff was raised the issue again in a motion to reconsider, trying to prompt the district court to make a legal determination as to the protection, whether her speech was protected or not, she asked the judge specifically on the record, should we still raise this in a Rule 50 motion? And Judge Sater said to her, I don't think, and I quote, I don't think that if we don't present it to the jury, you've got it as a ground for a motion in any event. So to now, and that's at volume one of...
That is, he says don't file a 50.
He said don't file a Rule 50 motion. So to, at this point, take us to task for not raising the issue in a Rule 50 motion hardly seems fair. I see that my time is up.
Oh, you've got time. Go ahead.
Okay. Also, in response to counsel's arguments that we should have somehow foreseen Garcetti and raised that exact issue about whether or not this was job speech, I think that has also been...
he said was the issue has already been filtering out in a number of cases, and this was one that wasn't. That's all.
Split it already evolved.
Right, but in Spiegla, I think that issue came up as well, and the court in that case said that as long as the issue of whether or not the speech was a matter of public concern was raised, that was enough to preserve a specific Garcetti issue. So
you are out of time.
Thanks. How much time does Mr. Furetti have? You have 2 minutes.
I think the problem of a separate trial here and why all of this was intertwined in the wrong way was shown in counsel's argument here before you for the plaintiff. He kept referring to they. I mean, the only reason we started objecting when I believe maybe the sheriff should have objected during the opening argument was that they created an alleged policy that Keith was tied to of
of sort, code of silence, clout.
Why didn't anybody make a motion for a new trial and define the issues?
Your Honor, as I sit here right now, all this time back, I don't recall. I really don't. Whether a new trial would have been granted?
Oh, I don't care what's been granted. It sure sharpens down the issues that would be able to be raised on appeal.
Well, and some of the issues, but you see, one thing that counsel referred to is, does a court have, if a court has no jurisdiction,
what
he's suggesting, exercise jurisdiction.
What he's suggesting, if you raise the issue in a motion for a new trial, you can give the trial judge a chance to correct the mistakes you're complaining about. If you don't raise it in a new trial, you just get stuck with whatever record you've gotten, however hazy it might be, like the Rule 50 motion, should it or shouldn't have been, and did he invite it or did he discourage it or what the heck happened, would have been clearly defined.
We have to look at ultimately whether or not the court had jurisdiction.
Yeah, but then you don't sleep on your other rights. I mean, once the court you didn't complain about supplemental jurisdiction and move to dismiss on that basis from the beginning. Then the trial proceeds. You don't just try the case, you know, thinking about maybe you'll file an objection to supplemental jurisdiction. You object to whatever is objectionable. And then you raise those issues in the Rule 50 if the court rules against you. I mean, because what you're saying is, look, you know, now
we
we're objecting to...
We have a very extensive post-trial motion, though.
Yeah, but you didn't move for a new trial. You didn't move for a new trial, right?
As I'm looking, you know what? I don't recall. I really don't.
You don't know whether you moved for a new trial or not?
I don't know if we did. We probably ultimately looking at with the post-trial motions, we would have asked, I believe it would have been.
Well, we'll look at them anyway. So
but the one thing I do want to point out, though, is that if a court has no jurisdiction, it can't take jurisdiction of a case. And that's our contention. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And thanks to all counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.